Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers. Hi, it's Richard Edelman. I'm CEO of Edelman, and today I'm joined by Jim VandeHei, journalist and media executive, co-founder, CEO, and chair of Axios. Before that, he was CEO of Politico, and he's also served as a journalist at the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post. And he's out with a great new book called Just the Good Stuff, No BS Secrets to Success, which I completely resonate with. So, Jim, you're a Wisconsin guy. You grew up in Oshkosh, went to UW Oshkosh, did not exactly kill it in terms of your grades, but you absolutely have made a huge success of your life. So just give us two or three quick tips how you did it.
Well, first, thanks for having me. And it's right. Like, one of the reasons I wrote the book is because I grew up in a small town. I was whatever the opposite of a spectacular student was. I was that. I was a crappy student and really a late bloomer. If you'd met me when I was 19, there's no way you would have said that guy's going to go start a couple companies and be a CEO and write a book. But I think looking back and reverse engineering it, a lot of it is the stuff that we learned growing up in the Midwest. Like, I was always a very hardworking person. I grew up going to dive bars and playing cards. And in retrospect, I think the lessons of being able to kind of fact pattern, recognize things, and be able to deal with people from different walks of life has helped me tremendously. And I've always been curious. Even when I was mischievous, I was always very curious in a mischievous way. And I think that has served me well.
And Jim, the Midwest part appeals to me, obviously, because my mom grew up in Kenosha and then Racine and went to University of Wisconsin to Madison. And I remember my grandmother, who was an immigrant from Russia, who had a big Russian accent and worked in a store starting at age 8. Sorting linens. And I remember how hardworking she was. And actually, she was 5'2" and would go around and collect rents in Racine. You knew people like this growing up.
For sure. And I grew up in my town. I had all four of my grandparents, and two of my grandmothers lived with us right before they had passed away. And so, you know, I have many generations to learn from. And my grandmother, on my father's side, actually was one of the few women going to Ripon College in Wisconsin back in the 30s. And so, you know, just had a lot of good examples. The other thing, which is like just a simple life thing, is just I had two parents who were very unconditionally loving, still are. They're both still alive at 81. And I think now that I look back, I think that was probably one of the reasons I had the confidence to go take chances and leave the Washington Post to start Politico and become an entrepreneur, just always having that safety net. And I think maybe we underestimate that as parents, the safety net that we could provide our kids by just loving them and kind of being there and encouraging them and being there when bad stuff happens.
My dad started Edelman in 1952, and he told the story of he walked into the CEO's office at the Tony Company and said, "Irving, I'm going to quit and I want to set up my own business." And the guy said, "You don't quit, you're fired." And he said, "Pack your bags and get out." And so my father sheepishly went back to the office and packed up his stuff. And the brother walked in and said, "Dan, don't worry, we'll be your first client." And so I thought about this when I read your book, and I guess Don Graham and a few other people really tried to get you to stay at the Post. And then you were kind of wavering. And then your wife sort of kicked you in the butt and said, "Come on, Jim, go for it."
Yeah. You know, at first, the Washington Post leadership loved us. Like, we were great reporters. And it was John Harris was the editor, political editor at the time. But, you know, back then, reporters didn't leave the Washington Post, and you certainly didn't leave it to start a competitor. So that they were baffled. But then, to their credit, they rallied and tried to get us to stay. And there was a moment, I always call it the famous coffee walk, where John Harris, who'd been at the Post a lot longer, came over, wanted to have one less gut check on whether to start the company. And as I walked out the door, my wife looked at me and she said, "He will not talk you out of doing this." And so we go for an hour and a half walk and he talks me out of doing it. So I walk in the door with this sheepish look on my face, and my wife goes apoplectic, gets on the computer, writes this letter to John Harris, to his wife, to me, quoting Churchill and Roosevelt and seizing the moment and getting in the arena and basically not being wimps. She turned the whole thing around and we started it. And eventually she actually named the company Politico. It was her idea.
Well, all credit to your wife. And then you and Mike had a second epiphany and went off and started Axios. Do you want to just walk through that?
Yeah, and that was a little more similar to the way you described your father starting Edelman, because we had started Politico. At the end, we decided we were going to go start something on our own. It wasn't the most amicable parting, But the minute that we announced that we were leaving, I think I had three or four different either CEOs or people at top Fortune 100 companies call me and say, man, we so love doing business with you guys that whatever you start, we're buying ads. We've already allocated money to it. Number one, it was awesome because it made you feel very confident about starting a company. But it's such a good lesson. One of the things that we did, and I really learned it from Mike Allen, was I never take it for granted when people do business with me. They can buy ads anywhere or they can read anything. And I've always tried to go out of my way to be very grateful, to thank people, to make sure that I make time for them because they're making time and they're making decisions that benefit us. And I think that really paid off in that interim. And so we started Axios 7 years ago. The whole idea was built around smart brevity, which is how do I help people get smart fast on a variety of topics, whether it's a communications industry or whether it's politics, AI, China. It's a lot for all of us in the professional class to learn. So we really wanted to bring efficiency and smarts together. And the company's been, you know, successful almost from day one, which has been very gratifying.
Our Edelman Trust Barometer special report on health showed a really disturbing decline in trust in health reporting over the last 5 years, like a 20 plus point drop in the US alone and mirrored in markets like Germany and Canada, et cetera, so that only 25% of people believe health reporting today. Is that just the shop window for distrust in media? And if so, what's the comeback?
Listen, you've done better research than anyone on this topic, and you guys have noted empirically just the decline in trust of everything. People just don't trust leaders. They don't trust institutions. Therefore, they don't trust the media as much. Therefore, they don't trust the journalist, which is a travesty. I think it's going to get harder and harder to run this very complex nation when people don't believe in anything. They might believe in their individual employer, but beyond that, they seem to have lost faith in everything. And it's really hurt our industry. It makes it really hard for me as someone who runs a big media company to persuade people that we're trying to get to the closest approximation of the truth so that we can arm them with better information to make better decisions. And if we live in a world where most of our people don't trust any big institution and they kind of just separate into their own bubble where it feels comfortable having your own personal biases reinforced, that's a dangerous place to be. I'm a big believer in this country and in the magic that our forefathers like put into democracy and the structure of our government. I believe at media, the fourth estate is a vital component of that. And I look around and I worry when people are tearing this stuff down.
Do you think that the media is partly to blame in this, that it's moved somehow between news and entertainment, newstainment, that in order to get eyeballs, you either are deeply controversial, chasing clicks, or you make it more like entertainment. And the ones who play it down the middle, like Axios, are somehow disadvantaged?
I think it would be foolish for anybody in the media to say that we've not been part of the problem. And if anybody's not doing a lot of self-reflection, they're delusional to the point of ineffective. So where did the media go wrong? I think where the media went wrong really was over the last 10 years, partly because of cable, mainly because of social media, starting to make it clear that they had their own personal opinions and that they were starting to seep into the coverage. And you'd watch them on Twitter, you'd watch them on MSNBC or Fox, and you could see they were picking teams. So those people who were persuadable potentially suddenly had every reason to distrust you. And then you had this whole cottage industry. You know, Trump's been quite good at it. But also people on the left have been very good at it about basically calling into the credibility of every single thing you read, even if it might only be a story or two that had those attributes. So we have a burden, an obligation to fix that. You know, one of the things we did with Axios is we said, listen, as hard as it is, whether you're selling ads or you're a technologist or you're a reporter, if you work here, we don't want you expressing yourself publicly about your politics, whether that's on Twitter, whether that's in giving money to politicians, whether that's in attending political rallies. And we know that's a lot to ask. But the reason we do it is we've got to do everything in our power to try to persuade the persuadables that they can trust us, because we as an industry are losing that battle.
There are four big trends in trust. One is the mass class divide, top 25 versus bottom 25. Second is that business has risen to be much more trustworthy than government based on competence. The third is the sort of battle for truth we've been talking about. And the fourth is now fears, rising level of fears, and in particular about innovation. Why do you think innovation is distrusted? I know about mRNA, of course. We had a difficult time in COVID. But even AI is trusted in the United States, like 1 in 5 people trust AI. Is it a lack of understanding?
It's a hard one to answer succinctly. So I think you could trace it back to the internet and in the creation of it. I think at some point, probably around 2005 to 2007, once the internet is fully in motion and you start to have the iPhone and your Android device and this suite of apps, everything started to change so fast for so many people, how they got information, how they work, how they did their job, how they communicated. And basically, technology started to move faster than the human mind is capable of keeping up with. I think that dynamic creates anxiety. I think during that period, a lot of people who used to hold really good jobs where they made good money with a real pension and that could support a family on it, particularly in the high-end manufacturing class, lost those jobs. Others lost to global trade. Put those things together and people start to worry that change is not benefiting them, even though I could argue change is benefiting them, but that is the perception that they're having. Along comes AI, and you have the creators of it who have a built-in incentive to kind of hype the technology to say that it could be smarter than humans, and maybe one day it will. It's nowhere near there now. So no wonder people fear it. And you put that on top of all this distrust of institutions to begin with, and you've got yourself a toxic stew. And I think it's unfortunate because, we live in this very complex, very fast-changing world. I would still argue that there's a huge disconnect between the reality and how people feel. I think if you live in the United States right now, by most measures, and I know people hate it when I say this, you're killing it. You are delusional. You are killing it. You look at your GDP growth. You look at the amount of energy that we're producing, clean energy, conventional energy, in our own country, for our own country. You look at having two oceans that protect you from enemies, two friendly, basically, neighbors to the north and south. You look at where AI is created. You look at where people want to flee and come work and live and create jobs if they are super talented. You've just got some amazing, amazing attributes. And yes, there's problems, but I think too often the loudest, most polarizing, provocative voices on social media create this reality of things being much worse than they actually are. And so we've got a lot to do as a society to change that. And it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to happen with better leadership in politics, in business, in churches, in communities. And if we don't get that, then we'll continue on this trajectory, which isn't a great one.
You and Mike wrote a really important piece in Axios saying that, in fact, polarization in the U.S. is overstated. That the goal lines may be 100 yards apart, but actually most of us are in the playing field somehow between the 40-yard lines or, you know, whatever the right football analogy is. And do you want to just go a little bit more into what you wrote?
Yeah. And again, some people hated the piece. I think we really tried to lay out the case just based on the data, right? Like most people are normal. Most people have a job. They're good neighbors. They're good people. They volunteer. They give money to charity. AP had a poll about the fundamental freedoms of speech and press and all the things that were built into the Constitution. 90% of Republicans, 90% of Democrats support those fundamental things. And so I think what has happened is if you look at social media and cable, so the people who shape our view of politics, they tend to be the most provocative and they tend to be very tribal in and of themselves and have a built-in incentive to do it. So it makes people feel like everyone hates each other more than they actually do, and that things are worse than they actually are. And I do think we need a grounding. There are bad things. There are hard things. And by the way, there always has been and there always will be. But this notion that everyone's a lunatic or that every Republican thinks that Trump is a second coming of Christ is just not true. And so we were trying to ground people just so they can have a more clinical view of the good and bad that is happening around them. And only through that will we be able to solve problems. And the reason, and then the counter to that is, wow, but look at how crazy the two parties are. Well, you only have two parties. You have a two-party system. You have for many, many decades, very hard to penetrate as a third party. So it is picking one versus the other. And the two parties, particularly the Republicans right now, have become a very Trump-focused party, have changed the rhetoric that they use, have changed the policies that they stand for, and it's created a lot more tension in politics than we're used to.
So I think one of the fundamental developments in trust has been that trust is local. and the trust is in my company, my CEO, even my company newsletter over mainstream media because somehow it's seen as more objective. And Axios has really bumped up its coverage in local markets. Do you want to go through your local market strategy? It's partly because local media is disintegrating your competitors, but it's also partly because it's believable.
It's believable. Like when national news is so distant from the consumer, but local news or even niche news, what something about your profession, you can touch, you can feel it, you can validate it. And so we've been going, we're in 30 cities now, you know, we're in San Diego, we're in the Twin Cities, we're in Denver, you go down the list, we're in 30 of the biggest cities. And the idea is to get the best local reporters to provide the best local journalism for readers who care. And our bet is that that'll be a really good business, that people care about the changing nature of their community. If we could be the one who's there while everything around us is disintegrating, we'll be in a really nice place. But it really is built around this idea of trust. And I see the same thing you do, right? It's not just your data, but your data might be the best in the business on it about trusting local business or your employer more than others. But that's true everywhere. And I think going back to your leadership question, I think people like myself and yourself who run companies and who run teams have a real obligation right now to understand that that's where people are, that they're trusting corporate and business leadership more than ever, and that we should take that seriously. We should carry that burden responsibly. And we should think about how do we help people get smarter? How do we make sure we create a really dynamic but safe work environment for people? How do we help them cut through what's real and not real? Because right now, we're kind of the last line of institutional defense. Outside of business, nobody trusts anything. And maybe that will change, but until it changes, I think business leaders shouldn't roll their eyes at that obligation. They shouldn't scoff when young people are saying, I want purpose and meaning from my work. You should provide them the purpose. You should provide them the meaning. Oh, and guess what? You have a massive incentive to do it. They will be just as productive, maybe even more productive than I was when I got into the workforce. But you're just motivating them differently. And that requires all of us leaders, many of whom are my age and older, to change the way that we lead. That's okay. People have changed how they lead throughout time.
So ESG, I've heard several CEOs say, I better not because Texas Pension Fund or West Virginia Pension Fund doesn't want to invest in my company if we're touting ESG. They may still be doing sustainability or diversity and inclusion, but they'll talk about it differently. What are you hearing and what are you advising?
Well, you see it. You see it in the quarterly briefings that companies give for shareholders. You just see it in the data. There's less of it. Again, there too, there probably was an overreaction. Everyone felt like so much pressure to weigh in on everything that suddenly companies were weighing in on everything, which is stupid to begin with. I never understood it when it was happening in real time. Any company, any leader just needs to figure out, what do we build? Who's our customer? Who are my workers? What do we stand for? We don't have a position on everything. I don't care if Nike has a position on immigration or some other topic. I want them to make me a really good shoe. And if I work there, I want it to be a really good employer. So figure out what you stand for. And if you figure it out in advance, tell your people you're not going to weigh in on things that sit outside of your core competency and things that drive your business value. And that's a fine position to have. And if CEOs would just be honest with their workers about it, say, man, I understand you feel passionate about that. I really do. I can't do anything about it because right here, when you're here, we're at work, we're building a product, we're serving a customer. And if it's relevant to that customer and product, we'll get involved. If not, that stuff has to take place outside of the workplace. But here are the things I care about. Here are the things we care about, why we care about them. And man, I hope they're as motivating and inspiring to you as they are to me.
Yeah, and I think a company like SC Johnson, which has made a big virtue of sustainability, for example, and changing its supply chain and plastics and all this sort of stuff, has made a huge change in business. And Unilever's Sustainable Living Plan, and also to really push behind diversity and inclusion, because that's what employees expect. They expect to be in a place that's making advance.
I don't understand this new debate about backing away from DEI. I understand that it's become a loaded term. You run a business in America. When I was born, 90% of America was white. Now it's about 60%. In 20 years, white people are going to be a minority in this country. It just is what it is. Like, that's demographics. You running a company, you want to have the most dynamic, productive workforce you possibly can. So you want to draw from every single pool of America. So why would you not fundamentally want to be a diverse company? And who the hell doesn't want to treat people fairly and make people feel included? It doesn't mean you have to go overboard and basically give in to every single protest that your staff has, but it does mean that you have to say ahead of time, this is what we believe in. This is how we think about diversity. This is how I'm trying to make sure you feel safe and included at work. This is how I'm thinking about people being treated equitably. Those are just natural human desires and instincts, and they make good business sense.
I want to talk about just the good stuff. The stuff that resonated with me was about discipline and resilience and having a good core and being about your family and making sure that you can drown out all the noise. Just keep it out of your head. Just concentrate.
For sure. I think part of this is like wisdom, right? We're older, right, Richard? We're getting older. What you realize is I'm only really good at work if I have my crap together outside of work, meaning for me, that means I'm kind of maniacal about what I eat, how often I work out, going to church, making sure my marriage is strong, making sure I have these special relationships with my kids, being attentive to my parents, getting enough fly fishing in, trying to learn how to play golf. If I do those things, I'm going to be a great CEO. If I'm letting those other things suffer and I'm not kind of holistically happy and kind of optimizing my own self, I'm just not going to be that good at my job. And like, I'm lucky, like you, I do something that I love doing with people I love doing it with. And I think all of us should aspire to that. I hit on that a lot in the book. Like, yes, there's times where we have an obligation to take care of our kids or our aging parents, but a lot of us have more flexibility than we think in getting the hell out of bad situations, whether it's relationships or it's people at work that are just sucking the life out of us. Man, life, we only got one run at it. You know, it might be 50 years, 60 years, 80 years. You only got one run at it. So allowing people to suck the life out of you and your happiness is just, to me, a non-starter.
But I also loved your idea somehow of being the Energizer Bunny in the company, that you have to provide the role model for others to say, okay, I'm going to follow this person because he or she is positive and is aware and awake, listens, but also when you decide, you have conviction and you don't wimp out.
I've read a lot. I've covered presidents. I've covered CEOs. I've been a CEO now. The one certainty is that your leadership is way, 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 way more contagious than you think, for good or bad. If you're a grumpy person, if you talk behind people's back, if you take shortcuts, if you're miserable, everyone else around you is going to be that way. Oh, the flip of it is if you work hard, if you're optimistic, if you don't raise your voice, if you demand yourself to be the best at what you do, guess what? Everyone else around you will do it. And you don't even have to say it. They pick it up through osmosis. People pick up on all these little ticks. And it's our job in being in a position of leadership to make sure that we are setting the tone. I make people, this is like a great culture at Axios, but it's a hard one in terms of like, you better be high achieving. You better be on a trajectory to be the best at what you do, or you're not going to make the cut. But you're not going to outwork me. You're not going to out-collaborate me. You're not going to out-candor me, because I need to set that tone if I'm going to ask everyone else to do it. So I would hope that all 550 people at Axios would say, yeah, like Jim sometimes pisses me off, but man, like he does work hard. He does seem to be at the top of his game. He does have really good fundamental values. He treats people well, and he is really, really, really candid.
Yeah, one journalist refers to me as relentless, which I take as a great compliment.
It's a wonderful compliment.
Yeah. And I think to be type A and to insist on excellence and to push yourself to be the best every day that you can be is essential.
You would probably agree that the more you do it, the more you want to do it, and the more it kind of allows you to do even more than you thought you were capable of. And that's a big part of the book, is that if you look back when I'm smoking a pack of cigarettes a day, eating pizza, basically delivering pizzas, getting crappy grades, you know, I watched other people around me who are a hell of a lot smarter and had their stuff together better than I did, tried to copy that. A lot of the book is me passing on their stories or me passing on all the dumb things I did when I had to teach myself to CEO. But I had the humility to reverse it and become a better CEO. And I hope I'm a pretty good CEO now.
You are beyond that. So Thank you very much for letting us into your life. And I hope that all my colleagues and others benefit from A, hearing this, but B, buy the book, because it's really an important read. And don't read it in one sitting. As he says, read it in multiple sittings, because it's a set of wisdom that you'll absorb. So Jim, thanks so much, pal. Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.